Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you two stories from Robert Barr, The Understudy, and Two Florentine Balconies. A crime story writer during the Sherlock Holmes era, Barr wrote the first Holmes parody, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, spelled S-H-E-R-L-A-K-O-M-B-S. A spoof that was continued a decade later in another Barr story, The Adventure of the Second Swag. Despite these jibes at the growing Holmes phenomenon, Barr remained on very good terms with its creator, Arthur Conan Doyle. Barr was also very good friends with Stephen Crane and was asked to complete an unfinished novel by the recently deceased American author. Barr reluctantly finished the last 8 chapters of The O'Ruddies due to his long-standing friendship with Crane and his wife. And now, our first story, The Understudy, by Robert Barr. The monarch in the Arabian story had an ointment, which, put upon the right eye, enabled him to see through the walls of houses. If the Arabian despot had passed along a narrow street leading into a main thoroughfare of London, one night, just before the clock struck 12, he would have beheld, in a dingy back room of a large building, a very strange sight. He would have seen King Charles I seated in friendly conversation with none other than Oliver Cromwell. The room in which these two noted people sat had no carpet, and but few chairs. A shelf extended along one side of the apartment, and it was covered with mugs containing paint and grease. Brushes were littered about, and a wig lay in a corner. A mirror stood at either end of the shelf, and beside these flared 2 gas jets protected by wire baskets. Hanging from nails driven in the walls were coats, waistcoats, and trousers, of more modern cut than the costumes worn by the 2 men. King Charles, with his pointed beard and his ruffles of lace, leaned picturesquely back in his chair, which rested against the wall. He was smoking a very black briar root pipe, and perhaps His Majesty enjoyed the weed all the more that there was just above his head, tacked to the wall, a large placard containing the words, "No smoking allowed in this room or in any other part of the theatre." Cromwell, in more sober garments, had an even jauntier attitude than the king, for he sat astride the chair with his chin resting on the back of it, smoking a cigarette in a meerschaum holder.
"I'm too old, my boy," said the king, "and too fond of my comfort. Besides, I have no longer any ambition. When an actor realizes that he will never be a Charles Keene or a Macready, then come peace and the enjoyment of life. Now, with you it is different. You are, if I may say so in deep affection, young and foolish. Your project is a most harebrained scheme. You are throwing away all you have already won."
"Good gracious," cried Cromwell impatiently, "what have I won?"
"Well, you have certainly won something,"
resumed the elder calmly,
"when a person of your excitable nature can play so well the somber, taciturn character of Cromwell. You have mounted several rungs, and the whole ladder lifts itself up before you. You have mastered 2 or 3 languages, while I know but one, and that imperfectly. You have studied the foreign drama, while I have not even read all the plays of Shakespeare. I can do 100 parts conventionally well. You will some day do a great part as no other man on earth can act it, and then fame will come to you. Now you propose recklessly to throw all this away and go into the wilds of Africa."
"The particular ladder you offer me," said Cromwell, "I have no desire to climb. I am sick of the smell of the footlights and the whole atmosphere of the theatre. I am tired of the unreality of the life we lead. Why not be a hero instead of mimicking one?"
"But, my dear boy," said the king, filling his pipe again, "look at the practical side of things. It costs a fortune to fit out an African expedition. Where are you to get the money?"
This question sounded more natural from the lips of the king than did the answer from the lips of Cromwell.
"There has been too much force and too much expenditure about African travel. I do not intend to cross the continent with arms and the munitions of war. As you remarked a while ago, I know several European languages, and if you will forgive what sounds like boasting, I may say that I have a gift for picking up tongues.
I have money enough to fit myself out with some necessary scientific instruments and to pay my passage to the coast. Once there, I shall win my way across the continent through love and not through fear.
You will lose your head, said King Charles. They don't understand that sort of thing out there, and besides, the idea is not original. Didn't Livingstone try that tact?
Yes, but people have forgotten Livingstone and his methods. It is now the explosive bullet and the elephant gun. I intend to learn the language of the different native tribes I meet, and if a chief opposes me and will not allow me to pass through his territory, if I find I cannot win him over to my side by persuasive talk, then I shall go round.
And what is to be the outcome of all of it?
Cried Charles.
What is your object?
Fame, my boy, fame, cried Cromwell enthusiastically, flinging the chair from under him and pacing the narrow room. If I can get from coast to coast without taking the life of a single native, won't that be something greater than all the play-acting from now till doomsday?
I suppose it will, said the king gloomily. But you must remember, you are the only friend I have, and I have reached an age when a man does not pick up friends readily.
Cromwell stopped in his walk and grasped the king by the hand.
Are you not the only friend I have? He said.
And why can you not abandon this ghastly sham and come with me, as I asked you to at first? How can you hesitate when you think of the glorious freedom of the African forest and compare it with this cribbed and cabined and confined business we are now at? The king shook his head slowly and knocked the ashes from his pipe. He seemed to have some trouble in keeping it alight, probably because of the prohibition on the wall.
As I said before, replied the king, I am too old. There are no pubs in the African forest where a man can get a glass of beer when he wants it. No, Ormond, African travel is not for me. If you are resolved to go, go, and God bless you. I will stay at home and carefully nurse your fame. I shall from time to time drop appetizing little paragraphs into the papers about your wanderings, and when you are ready to come back to England, all England will be ready to listen to you. You know how interest is worked up in the theatrical business by judiciously puffing in the papers, and I imagine African exploration requires much the same treatment. If it were not for the press, my boy, you could explore Africa till you were blind, and nobody would hear a word about it. So I will be your advance agent, and make ready for your homecoming.
At this point, the conversation between these two historic characters, the janitor of the theater put his head into the room and reminded the celebrities that it was very late, whereupon both king and commoner rose, with some reluctance, and washed themselves. The king becoming, when he put on the ordinary dress of an Englishman, Mr. James Spence, while Cromwell, after a similar transformation, became Mr. Sidney Ormond. And thus, with nothing of royalty or dictatorship about them, the two rolled up the narrow street into the main thoroughfare and entered their favorite midnight restaurant, where over a belated meal they continued the discussion of the African project, which Spence persisted in looking upon as one of the maddest expeditions that had ever come to his knowledge. But the talk was futile, as most talk is, and within a month from that time, Ormond was on the ocean, his face set towards Africa. Another man took Ormond's place at the theater, and Spence continued to play his part, as the papers said, in his usual acceptable manner. He heard from his friend in due course when he landed. Then, at intervals, came one or two letters showing how he had surmounted the numerous difficulties with which he had to contend. After a long interval came a letter from the interior of Africa, sent to the coast by messenger, although at the beginning of this letter Ormond said he had but faint hope of reaching his destination. He nevertheless gave a very complete account of his wanderings and dealings with the natives, and up to that point his journey seemed to be most satisfactory. He enclosed several photographs, most very bad ones, which he had managed to develop and print in the wilderness. One, however, of himself was easily recognizable, and Spence had it copied and enlarged, hanging the framed enlargement in whatever dressing room fate assigned to him, for Spence never had a long engagement at any one theater. He was a useful man who could take any part, but had no specialty, and London was full of such. For a long time he heard nothing from his friend, and the newspaper men to whom Spence indefatigably furnished interesting items about the lone explorer began to look upon Ormond as an African Mrs. Harris.
and the paragraphs to Spence's deep regret failed to appear. The journalists, who were a flippant lot, used to accost Spence with, "Well, Jimmy, how's your African friend?" And the more he tried to convince them, the less they believed in the peace-loving traveler. At last there came a final letter from Africa, a letter that filled the tender, middle-aged heart of Spence with the deepest grief he had ever known. It was written in a shaky hand, and the writer began by saying he knew neither the date nor his locality. He had been ill and delirious with fever, and was now at last in his right mind, but felt the grip of death upon him. The natives had told him that no one ever recovered from the malady he had caught in the swamp, and his own feelings led him to believe that his case was hopeless. The natives had been very kind to him throughout, and his followers had promised to bring his boxes to the coast. The boxes contained the collections he had made, and also his complete journal, which he had written up to the day he became ill. Ormond begged his friend to hand over his belongings to the Geographical Society and to arrange for the publication of his journal, if possible. It might secure for him the fame he had died to achieve, or it might not. But, he added, he left the whole conduct of the affair unreservedly to his friend, in whom he had that love and confidence which a man gives to another man but once in his life, when he is young. The tears were in Jimmy's eyes long before he had finished the letter. He turned to another letter he had received by the same mail, and which also bore the South African stamp upon it. Hoping to find some news of his friend, he broke the seal, but it was merely an intimation from the steamship company that half a dozen boxes remained at the south terminus of the line, addressed to him. But, they said, until they were assured the freight upon them to Southampton would be paid, they would not be forwarded. A week later, the London papers announced in large type, "Mysterious Disappearance of an Actor." The well-known actor, Mr. James Spence, had left the theatre in which he had been playing the part of Joseph to a great actor's Richelieu, and had not been heard of since. The janitor remembered him leaving that night, for he had not returned his salutation, which was most unusual. His friends had noticed that for a few days previous to his disappearance, he had been apparently in deep dejection, and fears were entertained. One journalist said jestingly that probably Jimmy had gone to see what had become of his African friend. But the joke, such as it was not favorably received, for when a man is called Jimmy until late in life, it shows that people have an affection for him, and everyone who knew Spence was sorry he had disappeared, and hoped that no evil had overtaken him. It was a year after the disappearance that a wan, living skeleton staggered out of the wilderness in Africa, and blindly groped his way to the coast as a man might, who had lived long in darkness and found the light too strong for his eyes. He managed to reach a port, and there took steamer homeward bound for Southampton. The sea breeze revived him somewhat, but it was evident to all the passengers that he had passed through a desperate illness. It was just a toss-up whether he would live until he saw England again. It was impossible to guess his age. So heavy a hand had disease laid upon him, and he had not seemed to care to make acquaintances, but kept much to himself, sitting wrapped up in his chair, gazing with a tired-out look at the green ocean. A young girl frequently sat in a chair near him, ostensibly reading, but more often glancing sympathetically at the wan figure beside her. Many times she seemed about to speak to him, but apparently hesitated to do so, for the man took no notice of his fellow passengers. At length, however, she mustered up courage to address him, and said, "There is a good story in this magazine. Perhaps you would like to read it." He turned his eyes from the sea and rested them vacantly upon her face for a moment. His dark mustache added to the pallor of his face, but did not conceal the faint smile that came to his lips. He had heard her, but had not understood.
"What did you say?" he asked gently.
"I said there was a good story here, entitled Author, Author, and I thought you might like to read it." And the girl blushed very prettily as she said this, for the man looked younger than he had done before he smiled.
"I am afraid," said the man slowly, "that I have forgotten how to read. It is a long time since I have seen a book or a magazine. Won't you tell me the story? I would much rather hear it from you than make an attempt to read it myself in a magazine.
Oh, she cried breathlessly. I'm not sure that I could tell it, at any rate not as well as the author does, but I will read it to you if you like.
The story was about a man who had written a play, and who thought, as every playwright thinks, that it is a great addition to the drama, and would bring him fame and fortune. He took this play to a London manager, but heard nothing of it for a long time, and at last it was returned to him. Then, on going to a first night at the theatre to see a new tragedy, which this manager called his own, he was amazed to see his rejected play, with certain changes, produced upon the stage, and when the cry, "Author, author," arose, he stood up in his place. But illness and privation had done their work, and he died, proclaiming himself the author of the play.
"Ah," said the man when the reading was finished, "I cannot tell you how much the story has interested me. I once was an actor myself, and anything pertaining to the stage appeals to me, although it is years since I saw a theater. It must be hard luck to work for fame and then be cheated out of it, as was the man in the tale. But I suppose it sometimes happens, although for the honesty of human nature, I hope not very often."
"Did you act under your own name, or did you follow the fashion so many of the profession adopt?"
asked the girl, evidently interested when he spoke of the theater. The young man laughed, for perhaps the first time on the voyage.
"Oh," he answered, "I was not at all noted. I acted only in minor parts, and always under my own name, which doubtless you have never heard. It is Sidney Ormond."
"What?" cried the girl in amazement. "Not Sidney Ormond, the African traveler?"
The young man turned his wan face and large, melancholy eyes upon his questioner.
"I am certainly Sidney Ormond, an African traveler, but I don't think I deserve the, you know. I don't imagine anyone has heard of me through my traveling any more than through my acting."
"The Sidney Ormond I mean," she said, "went through Africa without firing a shot, whose book, A Mission of Peace, has been such a success, both in England and America. But of course you cannot be he, for I remember that Sidney Ormond is now lecturing in England to tremendous audiences all over the country. The Royal Geographical Society has given him medals, or degrees, or something of that sort. Perhaps it was Oxford that gave him the degree. I am sorry I haven't his book with me. It would be sure to interest you. But someone on board is almost certain to have it, and I will try to get it for you. I gave mine to a friend in Cape Town. What a funny thing it is that the two names should be exactly the same."
"It is very strange,"
said Ormond gloomily, and his eyes again sought the horizon, and he seemed to relapse into his usual melancholy. The girl arose from her seat, saying she would try to find the book, and left him there, meditating. When she came back, after the lapse of a half hour or so, she found him sitting just as she had left him, with his sad eyes on the sad sea. The girl had a volume in her hand.
"There," she said. "I knew there would be a copy on board, but I am more bewildered than ever. The frontispiece is an exact portrait of you, only you are dressed differently and do not look—"
The girl hesitated.
"So ill as when you came on board?"
Ormond looked up at the girl with a smile and said,
"You might say with truth, so ill as I look now."
"Oh, the voyage has done you good. You seem ever so much better than when you came on board."
"Yes, I think that is so," said Ormond, reaching for the volume she held in her hand.
He opened it at the frontispiece and gazed long at the picture. The girl sat down beside him and watched his face, glancing from it to the book.
"It seems to me," she said at last, "that the coincidence is becoming more and more striking. Have you ever seen that portrait before?"
"Yes," said Ormond slowly. "I recognize it as a portrait I took of myself in the interior of Africa, which I sent to a dear friend of mine. In fact, the only friend I had in England. I think I wrote him about getting together a book out of the materials I sent him, but I am not sure. I was very ill at the time I wrote him my last letter. I thought I was going to die, and told him so. I feel somewhat bewildered and don't quite understand it all.
I understand it, cried the girl, her face blazing with indignation. Your friend is a traitor. He is reaping the reward that should have been yours, and so poses as the African traveller, the real Ormond. You must put a stop to it when you reach England, and expose his treachery to the whole country.
Ormond shook his head slowly and said,
I cannot imagine Jimmy Spence a traitor. If it were only the book, that could be, I think, easily explained, for I sent him all my notes of travel and materials. But I cannot understand him taking the medals or degrees.
The girl made a quick gesture of impatience.
Such things, she said, cannot be explained. You must confront him and expose him.
No, said Armand. I shall not confront him. I must think over the matter for a time. I am not quick at thinking, at least just now in the face of this difficulty. Everything seemed plain and simple before. But if Jimmy Spence has stepped into my shoes, he is welcome to them. Ever since I came out of Africa, I seem to have lost all ambition. Nothing appears to be worthwhile now.
Oh, cried the girl, that is because you are in ill health. You will be yourself again when you reach England. Don't let this trouble you now. There is plenty of time to think about it all before we arrive. I am sorry I spoke about it. But you see, I was taken by surprise when you mentioned your name.
I am very glad you spoke to me, said Armand in a more cheerful voice. The mere fact that you have talked with me has encouraged me wonderfully. I cannot tell you how much this conversation has been to me. I am a lone man, with only one friend in the world. I'm afraid I must add now, without even one friend in the world. I am grateful for your interest in me, even though it was only compassion for a wreck, for a derelict, floating about on the sea of life.
The tears were welling in the girl's eyes, and she did not speak for a moment. Then she laid her hand softly on Armand's arms and said,
You are not a wreck, far from it. You sit alone too much, and I am afraid that what I have thoughtlessly said has added to your troubles.
The girl paused in her talk, but after a moment added,
Do you think you could walk the deck for a little?
I don't know about walking, said Ormond with a little laugh, but I'll come with you if you don't mind an encumbrance.
He rose somewhat unsteadily, and she took his arm.
You must look upon me as your physician, she said cheerfully, and I shall insist that my orders are obeyed.
I shall be delighted to be under your charge, said Ormond. But may I not know my physician's name?
The girl blushed deeply when she realized that she had had such a long conversation with one whom she had never been introduced. She had regarded him as an invalid who needed a few words of cheerful encouragement. But as he stood up, she saw that he was much younger than his face and appearance had led her to suppose.
My name is Mary Radford, she said.
Miss Mary Radford? Inquired Ormond.
Miss Mary Radford.
That walk on the deck was the first of many, and it soon became evident to Ormond that he was rapidly becoming his old self again. If he had lost a friend in England, he had certainly found another on board ship, to whom he was getting more and more attached as time went on. The only point of disagreement between them was in regard to the confronting of Jimmy Spence. Ormond was determined in his resolve not to interfere with Jimmy and his ill-gotten fame. As the voyage was nearing its end, Ormond and Miss Radford stood together, leaning over the rail, conversing quietly. They had become very great friends indeed.
"But if you will not expose this man," said Miss Radford, "what then is your purpose when you land? Are you going back to the stage again?"
"I don't think so," replied Ormond. I shall try to get something to do and live quietly for a while.
Oh, cried the girl, I have no patience with you.
I am sorry for that, Mary, said Ormond,
for if I can make a living, I intend asking you to be my wife.
Oh, cried the girl breathlessly, turning her head away.
Do you think I would have a chance? Asked Ormond.
Of making a living? Inquired the girl after a moment's silence.
No, I am sure of making a living, for I have always done so. Therefore, answer my question. Marry, do you think I would have any chance?
And he placed his hand softly over hers, which lay on the ship's rail. The girl did not answer, but she did withdraw her hand. She gazed down at the bright green water with its tinge of foam. I suppose you know, she said at length, that you have every chance, and you are merely pretending ignorance to make it easier for me, because I have simply flung myself at your head ever since we began the voyage.
I am not pretending, Mary, he said. What I feared was that your interest was only that of a nurse in a somewhat backward patient. I was afraid I had your sympathy, but not your love. Perhaps such was the case at first.
Perhaps such was the case at first, but it is far from being the truth now, Sydney.
The young man made a motion to approach nearer to her, but the girl drew away, whispering,
There are other people besides ourselves on deck, remember?
I don't believe it, said Armand, gazing fondly at her. I can see no one but you. I believe we are floating alone on the ocean together, and that there is no one else in the wide world but our two selves. I thought I went to Africa for fame, but I see I really went to find you. What I sought seems poor compared to what I have found.
Perhaps, said the girl, looking shyly at him. Fame is waiting as anxiously for you to woo her as another person waited. Fame is a shameless hussy, you know.
The young man shook his head. No, fame jilted me once. I won't give her another chance.
So those who were twain sailed gently into Southampton docks, resolved to be one when the gods were willing. Mary Radford's people were there to meet her, and Armand went up to London alone, beginning his short railway journey with the return of the melancholy that had possessed him during the first part of his long voyage. He felt once more alone in the world, now that the bright presence of his sweetheart was withdrawn, and he was saddened by the thought that the telegram that he had hoped to send to Jimmy Spence, exultingly announcing his arrival, would never be sent. In a newspaper he bought at the station, he saw that the African traveller Sidney Ormond was to be received by the mayor and corporation of a Midland town, and presented with the freedom of the city. The traveller was to lecture on his exploits in the town so honouring him that day week. Ormond put down the paper with a sigh, and turned his thoughts to the girl from whom he had so lately parted. A true sweetheart is a pleasanter subject for meditation than a false friend. Mary also saw the announcement in the paper, and anger tightened her lips and brought additional color to her cheeks. Seeing how averse her lover was to taking any action against his former friend, she had ceased to urge him, but she had quietly made up her own mind to be herself the goddess of the machine. On the night the bogus African traveller was to lecture in the Midland town, Mary Radford was a unit in the very large audience that greeted him. When he came to the platform, she was so amazed at his personal appearance that she cried out. But fortunately, her exclamation was lost in the applause that greeted the lecturer. The man was the exact duplicate of her betrothed. She listened to the lecture in a daze. It seemed to her that even the tones of the lecturer's voice were those of her lover. She paid little heed to the matter of his disclosure, but allowed her mind to dwell more on the coming interview, wondering what excuses the fraudulent traveller would make for his perfidy. When the lecture was over and the usual vote of thanks had been tendered and accepted, Mary Radford still sat there while the rest of the audience slowly filtered out of the large hall. She rose at last, nerving herself for the coming meeting, and went to the side door, where she told the man on duty that she wished to see the lecturer. The man said that it was impossible for Mr. Ormond to see anyone at that moment. There was to be a big supper. He was to meet the mayor and corporation, and so the lecturer had said he could see no one.
"'Will you take a note to him if I write it?'
asked the girl. "'I will send it in to him, but it's no use. He won't see you. He refuses to see even the reporters,'
said the doorkeeper, as if that were final, and a man who would deny himself to the reporters would not admit royalty itself. Mary wrote on a slip of paper the words, "'The affianced wife of the real Sidney Ormond would like to see you for a few moments.' And this brief note was taken in to the lecturer. The doorkeeper's faith in the constancy of public men was rudely shaken a few minutes later when the messenger returned with orders that the lady was to be admitted at once. When Mary entered the green room of the lecture hall, she saw the double of her lover standing near the fire, her note in his hand, and a look of incredulity on his face. The girl barely entered the room, and closing the door, stood with her back against it. He was the first to speak.
"'I thought Sidney had told me everything. I never knew he was acquainted with a young lady, much less engaged to her.'
"'You admit, then, that you are not the true Sidney Ormond?'
"'Why, admit it to you, of course, if you were to have been his wife.'
"'I am to be his wife, I hope.'
"'But Sidney, poor fellow, is dead, dead in the wilds of Africa.'
You will be shocked to learn that such is not the case, and that your imposture must come to an end. Perhaps you counted on his friendship for you, and thought that even if he did return he would not expose you. In that you were quite right. But you did not count on me. Sidney Ormond is at this moment in London, Mr. Spence. Jimmy Spence, paying no attention to the accusations of the girl, gave a war whoop, which had formerly been so effective in the second act of Pocahontas, in which Jimmy had enacted the noble savage, and then he danced a jig that had done service in Colleen Bawn. While the amazed girl watched these antics, Jimmy suddenly swooped down upon her, caught her around the waist, and whirled her wildly around the room. Setting her down in a corner, Jimmy became himself again, and dabbed his heated brow with his handkerchief carefully, so as not to disturb the makeup.
"'Sidney in England again? That's too good news to be true. Say it again, my girl. I can hardly believe it. Why didn't he come with you? Is he ill?'
"'He has been very ill.'
"'Ah, that's it, poor fellow. I knew nothing else would have kept him. And then when he telegraphed to me at the old address, on landing, of course, there was no reply, because, you see, I had disappeared. But Sid wouldn't know anything about that.' And so he must be wondering what has become of me. I'll have a great story to tell him when we meet, almost as good as his own African experiences. We'll go right up to London tonight, as soon as this confounded supper is over. And what is your name, my girl?
Mary Radford.
And you're engaged to old Sid, eh? Well, 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 well. This is great news. You mustn't mind my capers, Mary, my dear. You see, I'm the only friend Sid has, and I'm old enough to be your father. I look young right now, but you wait till the paint comes off. Have you any money? I mean, to live on when you're married, because I know Sidney never had much.
I haven't very much either, said Mary with a sigh. Jimmy jumped up and paced the room in great glee, laughing and slapping his thigh.
Oh, that's first rate, he cried. Why, Mary, I've got over £20,000 in the bank saved up for you two. The book and lectures, you know. I don't believe Sid himself could have done as well, for he was always careless with money. He's often lent me the last penny he had and never kept an account of it, and I never thought of paying it back either until he was gone. And then it worried me.
The messenger put his head into the room and said the mayor and the corporation were waiting.
Oh, hang the mayor and the corporation, cried Jimmy.
Then, suddenly recollecting himself, he added hastily,
"Oh, no, no, don't do that. Just give them Sidney, Ormond's compliments, and tell his worship that I have just had some very important news from Africa, but will be with him directly."
When the messenger was gone, Jimmy continued in high feather.
"What a time we shall have in London. We'll all three go to old familiar theatres, yes? And by Jove, we'll pay for our seats. That will be a novelty. Then we will have supper where Sid and I used to eat. Sidney shall talk, and you and I will listen. And then I shall talk, and you and Sidney will listen. You see, my dear, I've been to Africa too.
When I got Sidney's letter saying he was dying, I just moped about and was of no use to anybody. Then I made up my mind what to do. Sid had died for fame, and it wasn't just he shouldn't get what he paid so dearly for. I gathered together what money I could and went to Africa, steerage. I found I couldn't do anything there about searching for Sid, so I resolved to be his understudy and bring fame to him, if it were possible. I sank my own identity and made up as Sidney Ormond, took his boxes and sailed for Southampton. I have been his understudy ever since, for after all, I always had a hope he would come back some day, and then everything would be ready for him to take the principal and let the old understudy go back to the boards again and resume competing with the reputation of MacReady. If Sid hadn't come back in another year, I was going to take a lecture trip to America. And when that was done, I intended to set out in great state for Africa, disappearing into the forest as Sidney Ormond, wash the paint off, and come out as Jimmy Spence. Then Sidney Ormond's fame would have been secure, for they would be always sending out relief expeditions after him and not finding him, while I would be growing old on the boards and bragging what a great man-friend Sidney Ormond was.
There were tears in the girl's eyes as she rose and took Jimmy's hand. No man has ever been so true a friend to his friend as you have been, she said.
Oh, bless you, yes, cried Jimmy jauntily. Sid would have done the same for me, but he is luckier in having you than in having his friend, although I don't deny I've been a good friend to him. Yes, my dear, he is lucky in having a plucky girl like you. I missed that somehow when I was young, having my head full of MacReady nonsense, and I missed being a MacReady, too. I've always been a sort of understudy. So, you see, the part comes easy to me. Now I must be off to that confounded mayor and corporation. I'd almost forgotten them, but I must keep up the character for Sidney's sake. But this is the last act, my dear. Tomorrow I'll turn over the part of explorer to the real actor, to the star.
And now, our second story, Two Florentine Balconies, by Robert Barr. Prince Padema sat desolately on his loft balcony in Florence and cursed things generally. Fate had indeed dealt hardly with the young man. The prince had been misled by the apparent reasonableness of the adage that if you want a thing well done, you should do it yourself. In committing a murder, it is always advisable to have someone else do it for you, but the prince's plans had been several times interfered with by the cowardice or inefficiency of his emissaries. So, on one unfortunate occasion, he had determined to remove an objectionable man with his own hand, and realized then how easily mistakes may occur. He had met the man face to face under a corner lamp in Venice. The recognition was mutual, and the man, fearing his noble enemy, had fled. The prince pursued, and the man apparently tried to double upon him, and with his cloak over his face, endeavored to sneak past along the dark wall. When the prince deftly ran the dagger into his vitals, he was surprised that the man made no resistance or outcry, made no effort to ward off the blow, but sunk lifeless at the prince's feet with a groan. Alarmed at this, the prince bade his servant drag the body to a spot where a votive lamp set in the wall threw dim yellow rays to the pavement. Then His Highness was appalled to see that he had assassinated a scion of one of the noblest families of Venice, which was a very different thing from murdering a man of low degree, whose life the law took little note of. So the prince had fled from Venice, and he took up his residence in a narrow street in an obscure part of Florence. Seldom had fate played a man so scurvy a trick, and the prince was fully justified in his cursing, for the unfortunate episode had interrupted a most absorbing amour, which, at that moment, was rapidly approaching an interesting climax. Prince Padema had been several weeks in Florence, and those weeks had been deadly dull. "The women of Florence," he said to himself briefly, "are not to be compared with those of Venice." But even if they had been, the necessity of keeping quiet, for a time at least, would have prevented the prince from taking advantage of his enforced sojourn in the fair city. On this particular evening, the prince's somber meditations were interrupted by a song. The song apparently came from the same building in which his suite of rooms were situated, and from an open window some distance below him. What caught his attention was the fact that the song was Venetian, and the voice that sang it was the rich, mellow voice of Venice. There were other exiles, then, beside himself. He peered over the edge of the balcony, perched like an eagle's nest high above the narrow stone street, and endeavored to locate the open window from which the song came, or better still, to catch a glimpse of the singer. For a time he was unsuccessful, but at last his patience was rewarded. On a balcony to the right, and some distance below his own, there appeared the most beautiful girl even he had ever seen. The dark oval face was so distinctly Venetian that he almost persuaded himself he had met her in his native town. She stood with her hands on the top rail of the balcony, her dark hair tumbled in rich confusion over her shapely shoulders. The golden light in the evening sky touched her face with glory as she looked towards it, of that part of it that could be seen at the end of the narrow street. The prince's heart beat high as he gazed upon the face that was unconscious of his scrutiny. Instantly the thought flashed over him that exile in Florence might, after all, have its compensations. "Pietro," he whispered softly through his own open window to the servant, who was moving silently about the room. "Come here for a moment quietly." The servant came stealthily to the edge of the window. "You see that girl on the lower balcony?" said the prince in a whisper. Pietro nodded. "Find out for me who she is, why she is here, whether she has any friends. Do it silently, so as to arouse no suspicion." Again his faithful servant nodded and disappeared into the gloom of the room. Next day Pietro brought to his eager master what information he had been able to glean. He had succeeded in forming the acquaintance of the signorina's maid. For some reason, which the maid either did not know or would not disclose, the signorina was exiled for a time from Venice. She belonged to a good family there, but the name of the family the maid also refused to divulge. She dared not tell it, she said. They had been in Florence for several weeks, but had only taken the rooms below within the last 2 days. The signorina received absolutely no one, and the maid had been cautioned to say nothing whatever about her to any person. But she had apparently succumbed in a measure to the blandishments of gallant Pietro. The rooms had been taken because of their quiet and obscure position. That evening the prince was again upon his balcony, but his thoughts were not so bitter as they had been the day before. He had a bouquet of beautiful flowers beside him. He listened for the Venetian song, but was disappointed at not hearing it, and he had hoped that Pietro had not been so injudicious as to arouse the suspicions of the maid, who might communicate them to her mistress. He held his breath eagerly as he heard the windows below open. The maid came out onto the balcony and placed an easy chair in the corner of it. She deftly arranged the cushions and the drapery of it, and presently the signorina herself appeared, and with languid grace seated herself. The prince had now a full view of her lovely face as the girl rested her elbow on the railing of the balcony and her cheek upon her hand. "You may go now, Pepita," said the girl. The maid threw a lace shawl over the shoulders of her mistress and departed. The prince leaned over the balcony and whispered, "Signorina, signorina." The startled girl looked up and down the street, and then at the balcony which stood out against the opalescent sky, the tracery of ironwork showing like delicate etching on the luminous background. She flushed and dropped her eyes, making no reply. "Signorina," repeated the prince, "I too am an exile. Pardon me. It is in remembrance of our lovely city." And with that he lightly flung the bouquet, which fell at her feet on the floor of the balcony. For a few moments the girl did not move nor raise her eyes. Then she cast a quick glance through the open window into her room. After some slight hesitation, she stooped gracefully and picked up the bouquet. "Ah, beautiful Venice," she murmured with a sigh, still not looking upwards. The prince was delighted with the success of his first advance, which is always the difficult step. Evening after evening they sat there later and later. The acquaintance ripened to its inevitable conclusion, the conclusion the prince had counted on from the first. One evening she stood in the darkness with her cheek pressed against the wall at the corner of her balcony nearest to him. He looked over and downward at her.
"It cannot be! It cannot be!" she said, with a frightened quaver in her voice,
but a quaver which the prince recognized, with his large experience, as the tone of yielding.
"It must be," he whispered down to her. "It was ordained from the first. It has to be."
The girl was weeping silently.
"It is impossible," she said at last. "My servant sleeps outside my door. Even if she did not, your servant would, and there would be gossip and scandal. It is impossible."
"Nothing is impossible," cried the prince eagerly. "Where true love exists, I shall unlock my door, and Pietro shall know nothing about it. He never comes unless I call him. I will get a rope and throw it to your balcony. Lock your door as I do mine. In the darkness, nothing is seen."
"No, no," she murmured. "That would not do. You could not climb back again, and all would be lost."
"Oh, nonsense," cried the young man eagerly. "It is nothing to climb back."
He was about to add that he had done it frequently before, but checked himself in time. For a moment she was silent. Then she said,
"I cannot risk your getting back. It must be certain. If you get a rope, a strong rope, and put a loop in it for your foot, and pass the other end of the rope to me around the staunchest railing of your balcony, I will let you down to the level of my own. Then you can easily swing yourself within reach. If you find you cannot climb back, I can help you by pulling on the rope, and you will ascend as you came down."
The prince laughed lightly.
"Do you think," he said, "that your frail hands are stronger than mine?"
"Four hands," she replied, "are stronger than two. Besides, I am not so weak as perhaps you think."
"Very well," he replied, not in a mood to cavil about trivialities. "When shall it be? Tonight?"
"No, tomorrow night. You must get your rope tomorrow."
Again the prince laughed quietly.
"I have the rope in my room now," he answered.
"You were very sure," she said softly.
"No, not sure. I was strong in hope. Is your door locked?"
"Yes," she replied in an agitated whisper. "But it is still early. Wait an hour or two."
"Ah," cried the prince, "it will never be darker than at this moment, and I think, my darling, how long I have waited."
There was no reply.
"Stand inside the window," whispered the prince.
As she did so, a coil of rope fell on the balcony.
"Have you got it?" he asked.
"Yes,"
was the scarcely audible reply.
"Then don't trust your own strength. Give it a turn around the balcony rail."
"I have done so," she whispered.
Although he could not see her because of the darkness, she saw him silhouetted against the night sky. He tested the loop, putting his foot in it and pulling at the rope with both hands. Then he put the rope around the corner support of the balcony.
"Are you sure the rope is strong enough?" she asked. "Who bought it?"
"Pietro got it for me. It is strong enough to hold 10 men.
His foot was in the loop, and he slung himself from his balcony, holding the rope with both hands.
"Let it go very gently," he said. "I will tell you when you have lowered enough."
Holding the end of the rope firmly, the girl let it out inch by inch.
"That is enough,"
the prince said at last, and she held him where he was, leaning over the balcony towards him.
"Prince Padima," she said to him.
"Ah," cried the man with a start, "how did you learn my name?"
"I have long known it. It is a name of sorrow to our family."
"Prince,"
she continued,
"have you never seen anything in my face that brought recollection to you? Or is your memory so short that the grief you bring to others leaves no trace on your own mind?"
"God!"
cried the prince in alarm, seizing the rope above him as if to climb back.
"What do you mean?"
The girl loosened the rope for an inch or two, and the prince was lowered, with a sickening feeling in his heart as he realized his position 100 feet above the stone street.
"I can see you plainly,"
said the girl in hard and husky tones.
If you make an attempt to climb to your balcony, I will at once loosen the rope. Is it possible you have not suspected who I am, and why I am here?"
The prince was dizzy. He had whirled gently around in one direction for some time, but now the motion ceased, and he began to revolve with equal gentleness in the other direction, like the body of a man who is hanged. A sharp memory pierced his brain.
"Mila is dead," he cried with a gasp in his breath. "She was drowned. You are flesh and blood. Tell me you are not her spirit."
"I cannot tell you that," answered the girl. "My own spirit seemed to leave me when the body of my sister was brought from the canal at the foot of our garden. You know the place well. You know the gate and the steps. I think her spirit then took the place of my own. Ever since that day, I have lived only for revenge. And now, Prince Padma, the hour I have waited for is come."
An agonizing cry for help rang through the silent street, but there was no answer to the call.
"It is useless," said the girl calmly. "It will be accounted as an accident. Your servant bought the rope that will be found with you. Anyone who knows you will have an explanation ready for what has happened. No one will suspect me. And I want you to know that your death will be unavenged, prince though you are."
"You are a demon," he cried.
She watched him silently as he stealthily climbed up the rope. He did not appear sufficiently to realize how visible his body was against the still, luminous sky. When he was within a foot of his balcony, she loosened the rope, and again he sunk to where he had been before, and hung there, exhausted by his futile effort.
"I will marry you," he said, "if you will let me reach my balcony again. I will, upon my honor. You shall be a princess."
She laughed lightly.
"We Venetians never forget, nor forgive. Prince Padma, goodbye."
She sunk faintly in her chair as she let go the rope and clapped her hands to her ears so that no sound came up from the stone street below. When she staggered into her room, all was silence. And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed The Understudy and Two Florence Balconies by Robert Barr. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.